So say you start with produce and you use the bacteria and yeast that are already present. That would be more of lacto fermentation and other things. So maybe with, like a yogurt or like with tempeh, like we were talking about, you have to add something to it. And over many, many hundreds or thousands of years, there are these cultures that they form these relationships. And just like you would think of a SCOBY on kombucha. So you have this organism and you think of it as one solid organism, but SCOBY is symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And they form these cultures that do specific functions. So with a kombucha SCOBY, it makes kombucha. With tempeh, that culture specifically breaks down the soybeans. With yogurt, it kind of turns it, dairy products a little bit thick. And that's probably another easy one that you can do. Just take some yogurt you already have and add that to some non-dairy or dairy milk, and
And
you
turn it into another
yeah.
one.
Hello, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I'm Carl from selfsufficienthub.com, and I'm here to talk about all things self-sufficiency. Sustainability and food security matters. Hello, and welcome to episode 86 of the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I hope you're all safe and well. Today I'm talking with Paul and Sarah from the Fermentation Adventure, and it was an absolute blast. They are great people, and they used to have a podcast some time ago, which I was actually a subscriber of. So it was great to actually finally meet them, albeit virtually. Anyway, we're talking about fermentation, and specifically fermentation for use as a preservation tool. So I won't bore you any more with the introduction. I will let the interview speak for itself and hand you over to that interview now. So hello, Paul and Sarah.
Hi, hello. Carl.
Hello, Carl.
I hope you're well, and thank you. You know, I'm great. I hope you're well, and thank you ever so much for joining us. For everyone listening along, there is a slight delay on the line here, so please forgive any slight talking over one another that we might do. But Paul and Sarah are here to talk today all about fermentation. Now, it's something that I've mentioned before on the show, but I've also mentioned that I'm not an expert on it and that I had hoped to get an expert or two involved, and here they are. So why don't you guys take the lead for a second and just tell us a little bit about what you do and why you do it?
So we're Paul and Sarah, and we run a YouTube channel and a website called The Fermentation Adventure. And years ago, I had a podcast called The Fermentation Podcast, but we have since transitioned over to video. But we were crazy about fermentation. We love self-sufficiency and all about the good flavors of food that you can create from fermenting things. There's all kinds of amazing things that you can create.
So while we run full-time jobs, our passion really has become fermenting and adventuring with it. So we've been trying out all different kinds of vegetables, sodas, really trying to help people get into the space of fermentation.
Well, that's awesome. That's really fantastic, because that's exactly why I've kind of asked you on the show today. So we're now in the Northern Hemisphere here. We're at the time of year where we're really starting to be harvesting quite a lot of our garden produce. And fermentation is just one of the many great ways of preserving food. So fermentation is something that a lot of people find there's a bit of a barrier to entry. It's a little bit like mysticism to them. So I'm hoping you can demystify some of that for my audience today. And can we start maybe just by talking about what fermentation is? Because there's lots of different types. And, you know, what is fermentation? How does it work? How does it preserve my food?
So basically, fermentation, you can just think of that in terms of nature. It's microorganisms breaking something down. And in that process, the byproduct and some fermentations, you know, maybe it creates alcohol, maybe it creates vinegar. It just helps preserve food, which is really good for us, and it also makes amazing flavors.
I've always thought it's amazing that our food ends up being preserved and kind of tastes like it's pickled, even though we can get into that in a minute. It's completely different than the pickling process, but it ends up tasting like there's vinegar, and yet that's just actually the natural process of creating that vinegar and that acetic acid.
Yeah, amazing with fermentation. I mean, the world, I don't know, in the past 100 years, we've only just gotten refrigeration. So, you know, people normally store everything in the refrigerator and they don't realize there's this whole other world that you can do, you know, preserving things.
Oftentimes, we'll make things and keep everything in the refrigerator. We actually have a second refrigerator in the garage that most people keep, beverages in. But ours is full of all kinds of ferments.
Yeah, because we're always experimenting. You know, we might be making all different kinds of sodas, and then, you know, we have all these bottles in the fridge, and we're normally bringing them to friends to try, and, you know, all of our friends are loving them, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I can definitely relate to that. I've got a fridge. We've got the main family fridge, and then next to that we've got what everyone in our house refers to as Dad's fridge. And in Dad's fridge is you know, kombucha and maybe some milk that I'm, you know, making kefir with, or yogurts and all those kind of things that are like projects. That's what that fridge is for. So I'm guessing when you say lots of drinks and things, you're talking about kombuchas and things of that nature, are you?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and our big kick recently has been using a ginger bug to create all kinds of sodas. So a lot of our videos recently have been focused on that and all kinds of Q&A on that, because there seems to be, like you said, this mystic, what is it and how do you do it? And actually, really all of fermentation we've found to be pretty simple. But there's not usually like a guidebook to it. It's just this, what you should expect, and we try and focus on that aspect of it. What are you looking for? What should it look like? What are signs to look for that means maybe something's gone a little awry? Things like that. But anyway, we've been focused on a lot of ginger bug fermented drinks. But our other fridge, as you mentioned, our other fridge definitely has some of those drinks in it. But we also have all kinds of like huge 2 gallon or a gallon size and
Oh yeah, sauerkraut.
and pickles and all kinds of things. Whenever
Wow.
something's in season, we just try and, stock up and make something with
Yeah.
it.
Excellent. Well, let's start there then. So if I'm going to talk about, you know, you've mentioned sauerkraut, and I'm going to mention it again now because it is something that I think a lot of people are familiar with. Now, I'm not a huge fan of sauerkraut. I don't mind it, but it's not one of my favorite things to eat. But it might be one of the gateway fermenting processes to talk about because it is ridiculously simple. It is something I've done with quite a bit of success. So perhaps would you mind talking us through what sort of things we might use that type of method for and how we would use that method and what that method looks like, how it works, and what we should be doing, you know, from a complete beginner, someone who's never tried fermenting before.
Oh yeah, so specifically sauerkraut, that's one of the easiest things you can make. And there's a whole lot of different ferments that are actually very simple. But sauerkraut, all you need is some kind of container. So we like to use glass. You can also use clay pots. So you have a container, you chop up all your cabbage, put it in the container, and then mix salt in there, and then all the salt starts to pull the liquid out of the cabbage, and then the cabbage becomes submerged in its own brine.
And I want to jump in and say that that's kind of the key to all of fermentation is keeping everything under the brine. If you can do that, most likely your ferments will turn out fine. But I also wanted to talk about just how cool it is to see the sauerkraut really start to wilt. We've done some time lapse on that. And so you put the sauerkraut, and once you put the salt in it, without any water, it just starts to create that liquid and create its own brine. It's really cool.
And it's not an exact science either. So say if you were just making a basic sauerkraut, you know, just maybe go to the garden, go to the store, get a cabbage, chop it up, put it in a bowl, and then just cover it with some salt. And then after a couple hours, you'll see it starts sweating. And then you just take all of that, transfer it into a jar, and pack it down as hard as you can. And then you'll have liquid that's covering everything. That's really the basic, sauerkraut. But you can get in and add all kinds of spices and make it taste good. And we also like to shred up maybe carrots and put it in there, and that makes it a little colorful. So there's definitely a lot of different recipes you can use.
And then how long do we have it sit on the counter? That's always the question.
Oh yeah. So basically with fermentation, it's not an exact science because, like gardening, you're dealing with nature. You can tell somebody to do it one way, but maybe they live in a different climate than you, or they have AC.
Sure.
So, but pretty much for us, our house is maybe 72 degrees year round. You would pack it in there, keep it below the brine, and then just leave it sitting on the counter. And then after like a day, 2 days, 3 days, you'll start to see bubbles coming up. And you might have a completely finished sauerkraut within a couple weeks. And all you have to do is make sure everything stays below the brine. Because the way fermentation is, the way the natural process works is, say, everybody's scared of mold. That's probably the number one thing people are scared of, getting mold. And of
Yeah.
course, you don't want to eat mold. So the way we can kind of partner with nature and create an environment that you don't have any mold is, mold loves oxygen. And that's what we want to get rid of when we're talking about vegetable ferments. We want to keep oxygen away from your ferment. So you want to create an environment that's kind of oxygen free. As it's fermenting, it's releasing all this gas, and it kind of pushes the oxygen up out of the jar. And when you have everything weighed down in a liquid environment, there's no oxygen in there, or very, very, very low oxygen. So you just keep everything below the brine, and maybe a week, 2 weeks. As it's fermenting, what we also like to do is take a little bit of it and taste it as it goes. And it's kind of a personal preference too, because the same thing with pickles. When you do pickles, a similar method, maybe you want a half sour pickle or a full sour pickle. As it's going along, maybe you'll take some out, taste it. As it's progressing, you'll notice the pH is becoming very acidic. Maybe, if you want a half sour, you wait a few days. If you want a full sour, maybe like a week.
So a taste test is pretty important. Like I like a half sour and I would stop it there after just a few days and Paul would go a whole week. He would prefer probably
Oh,
the full
yeah.
sour.
Yeah, love
Sure.
sour. Yeah,
So
also
how
same.
do you sorry, you so
That's
you
all right.
just said you'd stop it at a certain point. So how exactly would you stop it from becoming more sour? What's the process there? Is it just to put it in the fridge, or is there some other way?
Yep, that's basically all it is. Maybe with commercial, companies, they would sterilize it, the canning process. But since, with fermentation, this is alive. You don't want to kill anything because, you want all the beneficial probiotics. You just put it right into the refrigerator, or maybe if you have a root cellar, if you're in that, part of the world where it doesn't flood, put it down in
Sure.
your root cellar, just a place where it's cool.
And when you do that, so you're putting it in the refrigerator, and what it's doing is really slowing down the process. It doesn't completely stop it. It's not like a preservative or something that would just completely stop the process and kill things potentially. But when you're putting it in the fridge, it just really slows it down to such a slow degree that it essentially stops your fermentation. But you got to keep in mind that it does actually continue just ever so slightly, slowly. So if you put it in there and leave it in the refrigerator for about a year, you're going to notice a little bit of a difference in taste. So we like to recommend that you kind of eat your ferments maybe within the year, even a year later is fine. And we've eaten some things maybe 2, 3 years later, tried some hot peppers. The only issue is taste. It's still just fine. It's hasn't gone bad, but the taste might have started to kind of become a little stale.
Yeah, we've made peppers years old, and there's absolutely no mold on top because everything's below the brine. And then you taste it, and it just tastes a little stale. So, when you're dealing with garden produce and anything that you want the flavor there, you would ferment something and have it, as a side dish, or have it as a condiment, or this is like a whole world of flavors that it's going to open up, because we've made things like our fermented peppers, fermented hot sauce. It tastes completely different than anything you can buy. We've never tasted anything quite like it. And, you know, until you make something at home like this, it's really exciting the first time you take a bite of something that you've made yourself and fermented.
It's really easy for you to get in touch with us. You can do it either by sending an email to selfsufficientcontact@gmail.com or by using the link in the show notes to send us a voice message. You can send us a voice message just using your phone. You could also reach out to us on Facebook, where we have the Self-Sufficient Hub group and the Self-Sufficient Hub page. We're always thrilled to get your feedback, questions, or suggestions for future topics on the show.
The sort of method that we've already spoke about, the method of using salt to draw out the moisture that's already in the, for instance, cabbage that we've spoke about, and then effectively that moisture that comes out of the plant material, that creates the brine. So two questions for you. Firstly, what is brine? The term brine, what does it mean? And because there's other ways that we can make brine, isn't there? And secondly, what other types of food lend themselves to that method of fermenting?
So brine is really just a salt mixture. So you have a liquid that has a certain salinity. And I guess as an aside, I have to mention, you technically don't need to use salt to ferment, but it makes it taste a lot better. As long as you're keeping everything below, you know, a liquid level, then you don't need it. But of course, you know, the salt also with mold, it kind of creates an environment where mold doesn't like high salt environments. So the same thing with the curing process with meats. If you put a lot of salt on something and maybe even a little bit of vinegar, it just makes it to where, you know, it wards off mold. So, but sure. Say another ferment that's somewhat similar to cabbage, not quite because there's not as much liquid, would be kimchi. So that's another type of cabbage. And then you put some spicy spices. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like a cool one too. But say if you're wanting to preserve other things like maybe green beans or carrots or cucumbers or, you know, anything that you would want to preserve, you would actually mix up a salt brine. So you would take non-chlorinated water, and that's another thing we'll have to talk about. So you take water and salt, just mix it together in a ratio that pretty much, you know, what you would like the flavor of. And normally we'd mm-hmm. like to use, you know, just like maybe a tablespoon, or depending on what we're making, a tablespoon for a mason jar, like a quart size. And then, so you prepare all of your produce. So say maybe carrot sticks is kind of a fun one for kids. So chop up the carrot sticks, pack them into a jar, put some spices like maybe dill, maybe a couple smashed garlic cloves, and then just cover all that with your salt brine. And then all you have to do, since everything likes to float with produce, you get kind of a weight and put it on top, and that holds everything below the brine. With sauerkraut, you're packing it in so hard and maybe putting a leaf on top of it. It packs in so hard that it keeps itself below the brine. But with other ferments, you want a weight. So if you're just getting started, the very easiest that you can do would be to get a mason jar and put your ingredients in, cover it with a salt brine. And if you have a little tiny jelly jar, you can actually fit that into the mouth of the jar and weigh everything down. When we first started, there wasn't a whole lot of cool little gadgets out, but now they have really handy glass fermentation weights, and you just kind of drop that in there and it holds everything down. You put a cap on, but
you can get started pretty simply.
Oh yeah. If you mm-hmm. want to very simply, you know, just take an old pickle jar you have or a pasta jar, you can do that. Just make sure you weigh everything down, put the brine in there. And as it goes along, we've tested it with pH strips, and the pH starts dropping into acids. So it starts getting a little more acidic. So with fermentation, like we've always considered it just, another arrow in your quiver. So we have our long-term food storage. We have the canned food storage, which is great. And then, you have fermentation, which the ferments are like the flavors and, the celebration in the food world. Every time you have a party and you pop a champagne bottle, that's fermentation. Coffee has a little bit, a coffee and on chocolate, they have a little bit of fermentation in, their processing. So.
Yeah, and cheese and bread and all the other amazing things that we love to eat. They're all involved in everything, aren't they? So is there anything that we couldn't preserve using this simple saltwater technique? Because it almost sounds too simple for our garden produce. And I'm actually going to harvest some beans today, and I'm going to do this simple saltwater that you just mentioned. And I'm just thinking, it sounds too simple. Is there anything we can't do by using this method from garden produce?
Garden produce. I've heard of, there's different methods of fermenting where, say, you put an oil, ferment in oils and things like that. But essentially, I
would think everything you grow in a garden, you pretty much could use a salt brine method in.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that I wouldn't do that with.
There's actually some things that you would have to be careful with. So say maybe like tubers, like different potatoes, like cassava, and there's some other tubers, some root vegetables.
Beetroot?
Beets are actually great to ferment.
Yeah, they're great.
But there's some tropical roots that you have to be careful with because the toxicity is a little bit too much. And you have to prepare them in kind of a different way. But when you're thinking of just regular produce you would be growing to eat,
like above the ground, you'd be a little more safe on the salt brine method.
Yeah, and some other tubers like sweet potatoes and beets and ginger, that's all perfectly fine.
Yeah, so rare instances where maybe you wouldn't, but essentially everything that's growing in your garden would pretty much be okay. Yeah. And you could always do a quick Google search to see if there's like a recipe out there. And if there is, then it's most likely just fine to use a simple salt brine recipe.
Yeah. And there's different ways of doing different things. So say you like a lot of hot peppers, maybe you could cover those in a salt brine, with some spices and things. And then, you can have them as on top of a meal. Or if you take and blend them up really well, and maybe you can leave them like that or strain them, then you have a nice hot sauce.
If you can't tell, we're all about flavors.
You're not alone. I absolutely love spicy chilies and spicy food. And brining is actually how I preserve our jalapenos and things like that that we grow here, because it's just so simple. And so I think that it almost feels like, and I know this is ridiculous, but from someone who's very, very new to using fermentation as a method of preservation, it almost felt like doing it with hot chilies was a little bit safer, a little bit more comfortable way to get in, because it's completely irrational, but you kind of feel that the heat of the chilies are also going to ward off some of the bacteria for you. So you don't have to be quite so knowledgeable, but salt brining then, it sounds like a really great thing to have a dabble in and get used to using as a preservation method. Is there anything we should watch out for if we're salt brining? Is there anything we should be cautious of? Any other information you think we might need to know before we talk about some other methods?
Definitely the non-chlorinated water is key. And people ask us all the time if you can boil out the chlorine or let it sit on the counter to kind of evaporate out. And you pretty much cannot do that. So a lot of chlorinated water, I'm not sure about like in the UK, but different parts of the world as well, they're now including not just chlorine, but what was it called?
Yeah, I think there's even kind of like an ammonia. So I guess just an explanation of what we're talking about. In fermentation, like I said, we're dealing with living systems. So you have all these little bacteria and yeast that are eating the sugars in your produce and, your fermented drinks. And so if you put chlorinated water, the chlorine keeps your water clean, which is great. We don't want to get sick. But when you have chlorine in your water, it kills all of those organisms. So that's probably the biggest thing. If you use chlorinated water and you're trying to ferment something, then you're not going to see the action and, you know, the bubbles and the little fermentation processes that, you know, you should be expecting. So you definitely, that's the biggest thing, you know, using non-chlorinated water and keeping it below the brine.
You can now support the show directly. Just go to patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. You can become a patron and set up to donate to the show from any amount. Pledging as little as $3 a month makes a huge difference. If that's not your thing, you can also support the show by sharing it with people you know or posting about it on social media. We really appreciate all the help that you give us. It's people like you that make this show possible.
There's a few different methods or, you know, a few different tips for that. So really, say if you want the easiest possible, you just go to the store and buy some distilled or spring water. But really what we like to do is we have a filter. So maybe you have a filter on your refrigerator and it just takes the chlorine out of it. And say if your municipality, so say here in the States, our cities, you know, they have big plants and they add chlorine. Sometimes if you have just like a regular chlorine, you can leave maybe a gallon of water, or, you know, in a pot and just let it off gas the chlorine, kind of like you would think of in a pool, how your pool loses the chlorine for like a few days. But that's starting to become a little bit harder as they add different chemicals. So really the best way is just to have some kind of a water filter. Mm-hmm. So,
but then you're asking what to look for. I think of also mold and potentially comm yeast. So those are two things that people ask about all the time that would look worrisome on the top of your ferment. So that's something to look out for as you're fermenting. If you get a layer that is very flat and kind of all white along the top, and if you smell it and it smells kind of like bread, like you just baked some bread, it's very yeasty. Yep. That's actually comm yeast, and that's actually okay to scrape off. And it's actually, so it's perfectly fine, but you wouldn't want to stir it in because then it might actually affect the taste of your ferment. So you just would want to scrape that off and then you can continue fermenting. So that's a possibility. With mold, I would recommend starting over on a ferment. So you really hope you don't get mold. But that one is something to look for if it looks fuzzy and if it's kind of localized to one specific area. And that usually will happen if it's not submerged under the brine. So you should be okay. As long as everything's under the brine, you shouldn't run into any mold.
Yeah, most of the time you'll see, like we've gotten mold on different ferments, and it always forms on the top as a solid layer. And
it's kind of fuzzy, kind of dark.
There's actually some people, and you know, it might be true where you can just scrape it off and eat what's below the brine. We're not necessarily comfortable with that. And some people are comfortable with just scraping it off. And probably the biggest person on fermentation that, you know, has created the most popular books is Sander Katz. He's created The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation. He's very comfortable with just when he makes a big barrel of something, a lot of times there'll be mold on top. He'll just scrape it off and eat what's below the brine. We just end up starting over because it's not hard for us because it's just a little jar of something. So, you know, you don't know if the mold spores get into the liquid, you know, just we're not necessarily comfortable with that. So
I actually have a little tip that I would recommend, though, to to make sure that you're not going to get mold or see what you're working with. If you've never fermented before, rather than just taking a big batch of something you have and trying to ferment the entire thing right away, you want to kind of test it. I would recommend doing a little quart size jar of that, you know, your ferment, use the water you're going to use and see how it goes. Give it a few days. If everything looks safe, you know, and fine, like everything stays under the brine, you don't get any mold, it tastes good, then you could do the big batch. That's the way I'd do it, especially when it comes to preserving, because you wouldn't want to make a whole batch of something and have it go bad. That would just be a shame.
Other way, a couple other tips. There are a lot of new little tools available now. There are fermentation lids. So along with a little fermentation weight, maybe you would use some kind of a glass weight to keep everything below the brine. There's lids now that have just a little opening. They're made of silicone. There's even there's also ones that are airlocks. You know, the traditionally with fermentation crocks, A long time ago, and even today, there are people, they have these gigantic clay crocks. It's a German crock. And around the top, there's a little crevice, and it's a moat. You fill that with water, and then you take a lid and put that on top, and it locks out all of the air. So the new little tools today that you can screw on top of mason jars, it does the exact same thing. But the big crocks nowadays, they're just so heavy. You have to clean them, and they're just so heavy. Dealing with the mason jar, it's a lot easier. You can make little batches of other flavors of something.
Okay, so let's have a little bit of a dabble with other forms of fermentation then, because we've spoke quite a bit about brining. Unless you've got anything else to add on that subject, let's talk about what other options are available to us.
Perfect. Yeah, we've probably gone over that in detail, huh? Other
Sure.
types would be great.
Oh yeah, so
Okay,
some
well.
other favorites that we have are lately we're on a fermented drink kick. So there's a lot of fun fermented drinks that you can make. And probably the easiest way you can do that is something called a ginger bug. And so you take ginger, you chop it up, and you put on sugar, and then you kind of make that into a starter culture. And then you make another batch of something, like a soda, kind of like a maybe like a soda syrup, I guess. You add that to it, and then you're making your own homemade fermented sodas. So imagine, you're out in the country, maybe you don't want to go to the store and buy fermented sodas, and you have kids that they love soda. You can make healthy sodas that are they're fun, they're fizzy, they're almost like champagne in a way. So that's been a lot of fun.
Well, I've got a quick question for you, actually, and it's a question that I get asked an awful lot. And it's because I make a lot, as I've already mentioned, of kombucha, and I give quite a lot away. And I'm always about the sugar content. And my answer is that basically the SCOBY and the bacteria metabolize the sugar. So while the sweetness that they taste is from sugar, the amount of actual sugar that's in the finished product is nothing like the amount of sugar that's used to create it. And I'd like you to give me a sort of line check there and tell me, am I how right or wrong am I?
On the sugar content, it really does depend on how long you ferment it. So when you first make a soda syrup, you might be kind of shocked at how much sugar that you put in to begin with. So maybe we're making a batch of ginger ale, and in a gallon, we probably use 2 cups of sugar. And it looks a little shocking, but then as the fermentation process goes along, all the bacteria and yeast, they're eating the sugar and creating alcohol. So that's kind of another thing to think about. So for people that are worried about the sugar content, you can use less sugar, but it just won't be maybe as active, and it won't be as, some people are actually trying to make alcohol. So if the more sugar you use, the more alcohol you're going to have. So with kombucha, normally you're not fermenting very long, so maybe only a handful of days or so. So if it still tastes pretty sweet, there's still going to be a good amount of sugar in there. It just depends on how long you ferment. We've been lately testing the alcohol content, and it's kind of fun when you start with something and you test the density of it, and at the end, after it's done fermenting, it's less dense because there's less sugar in it, and you can actually measure that.
Well, I tend to ferment for 2 weeks. I do, roughly speaking, it obviously varies, but roughly a week outside the fridge and then a week inside the fridge for a first and second ferment. Is that pretty standard procedure?
Oh yeah, that sounds pretty standard.
That sounds like it would probably go through a lot of the sugar as well. So you're, of course, you're still going to have some residual sugar in there, but Not nearly what you started with.
yeah.
And a lot of
No.
things with our sodas, we always tell people to it's kind of to taste as well. So if anybody was concerned about having a lot of sugar in there, they could of course start with less, and then as the process fermentation process goes along and some of the sugars get eaten, it will be a little drier, but you'll also have less sugar.
And some people wonder, can you just not even use sugar at all? But if you want the carbonation and you want that flavor, then you do have to use sugar. it's the fuel that all the bacteria and yeast are using, kind of like gasoline in a car.
Yeah. Can you use honey?
You can definitely use honey, but it might take a little bit longer just because honey is already kind of antimicrobial. I mean, there's sure. honey that's been discovered in ancient Egypt that's actually still good after all of these hundreds and thousands of years. So it's definitely a preservative.
But it can be done.
Yeah.
I know, though we get asked, can you do it with like sugar substitutes? And that I would say, not really. You don't want to be preserving or doing something with chemicals. And I don't think that would work very well. It definitely needs to have that sugar, like cane sugar or some sort of actual sugar, honey, something
maple
like
syrup.
That. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you definitely need the fuel.
With the bacteria, I guess they need something to metabolize that's got that calorific content, don't they? That's part of the whole purpose of it to them.
Exactly.
So I've fermented using just honey and using honey to preserve garlic, just really simply, that literally just use the honey as a brine almost. And I'm just wondering what other types of fermentation you would normally recommend to someone who's looking for ways of preserving their food.
You can find Self-Sufficient Hub content elsewhere online in lots of other places. We have a YouTube channel. We also have our website. And now there's our Facebook page and Facebook group. Links to all of these you can find in the show notes. Come check us out.
So you could do some things with kind of like a sugar brine as well, is essentially what you're doing with making the sodas. So even if you didn't really make it into a soda per se, if you were doing berries or anything that's actually naturally sweet as well, even adding a little bit of sugar in there and making it like a sugar brine.
Like a chutney.
Yeah, you'll have a similar type of fermenting process, but with sugar instead. But of course, you may create a little alcohol in the process as well.
There's also, you know, other sure. different types of fermentation, you know, that you would consider ferments, like sourdough bread. And that really just changes the flavor of it. So maybe if you don't want to use yeast, you can start a sourdough starter and just use that. It really makes a great tasting bread.
And we've made a lot of great sourdough in the past, but we're looking forward to trying our hand at that as well again. We have some of our old sourdough starter still in the fridge and kind of want to revive it and see if we can. So that's really exciting project for us coming up.
Yeah, there's also, there's many other types. So say, you know, we're thinking of salt brines and maybe sourdough, but there's also things like tempeh, which uses kind of like it's almost like a mold in a way. So you start with soybeans and you add this culture to it, and it turns it into a solid mat, and it's really just breaking down the beans of the soybeans, and it just makes it more digestible. That's the other nice thing about fermentation.
Well,
when you ferment something, it makes it more digestible.
Yeah, for sure. And what's that method called again? Could you spell it? It's not something I've heard of.
Oh, tempeh?
Oh, yeah, tempeh. So when you think of soybeans, and, you know, some people say soy is bad for you, but if you prepare it traditionally, so with...
Well, let me spell it for you first. Tempeh is T-E-M-P-E-H.
And that's really almost like you could kind of consider that a meat substitute in a way. So you have, imagine you have a bowl of soybeans, and imagine they all solidified into one solid block. And then you can cut it up into slices and make it into almost like a nutty meat substitute. That's a really interesting one.
That's become very popular here. So,
along the same lines as soybeans, there's miso. So, and that's almost more of like a curing process for many, many months. There's yogurt. So a lot of people are, you know, they love yogurt, whether it's on dairy or non-dairy. You just add a little culture to it. So say you start with produce and you use the bacteria and yeast that are already present, that would be more of lacto fermentation. And other things, so maybe with like yogurt or like with tempeh, like we were talking about, you have to add something to it. And over many, many hundreds or thousands of years, there are these cultures that they form these relationships. And just like you would think of a SCOBY on kombucha. So you have this organism and you think of it as one solid organism, but SCOBY is symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And they form these cultures that do specific functions. So with a kombucha SCOBY, it makes kombucha. With tempeh, that culture specifically breaks down the soybeans. With yogurt, it kind of turns it, dairy products a little bit thick. And that's probably another easy one that you can do. Just take some yogurt you already have and add that to, some non-dairy or dairy milk and, you
turn it into another one.
Yeah.
A lot of times that's what we'll do too. It's kind of use part of our, something we already have in the refrigerator that's been fermenting, like pickles or the hot sauce. And you can use some of that as a culture starter for a future ferment. So sometimes you don't even have to start over with just a salt brine. You can actually use something that's already fermenting. It already has the bacteria you want. And you actually just add that like you would a ginger bug. It just is a culture starter and you add it to a separate batch of, whatever you're fermenting.
Yeah, and you can make your own. You can also maybe you go to a bakery that you really love the bread and, you make friends with the baker and ask, can I have a little bit of your sourdough mother? And then, you can make your own sourdough from that sourdough. And, there's world famous bread around the world that everybody has their own version of sourdough because it's different bacteria and yeast around the world.
Yeah. And I know vinegar is another one in Italy. It's very, very common for a family to have had a mother of vinegar that's been passed down for several generations, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's another one you can maybe borrow from somebody, or maybe if you get a bottle of apple cider vinegar, you can use that as a starter. Yeah, that's some good flavor there. That's also another aside. When you're creating these ferments, say you make these pickles and you have the brine left over, don't throw the brine away. You can actually use that. Maybe you make a pot of rice, instead of having however many cups of water you use like a fourth of the brine, a fourth of the water, use brine instead, and you add a lot of flavor and nutrition.
Wow.
And I like to use it as salad dressing. So any of the brine we have left over, especially like we had this pickled cauliflower, it's fermented cauliflower, and we put a lot of Indian spices in it. So it was very flavorful. I was using that as my salad dressing.
Oh my God, that never would have crossed my mind, but I'm really excited about that now. A great idea,
Some people even drink
quite
it.
Often... I quite often reuse my brines as a brine, and there's nothing wrong with that, I'm guessing. Would you like to put me straight? But I'm under the impression that I can basically just reuse brine as long as I'm not seeing any of that mold that you mentioned.
Say you make a ferment. So say you make full sour pickles and you have the brine left over. At some point, it reaches a certain acidity where it's just done. Now, if you were to take all the pickles out of there and you have the brine left over and you put fresh pickles or fresh cucumbers into there, it's still fermenting, but you're almost using the pickling process. So when you're pickling something, it's different than just starting with the fermentation process. It's still alive and you just might get different results. So it's something fun to play around with also.
Got you. But from a safety point of view, there's no real issues there. So long as we've not got the mold.
Yep. Yeah. You can use the brine, keep reusing it. And you'll probably make some pretty tasty stuff. As long as it doesn't have mold, that's keep everything below the brine. That's probably the number one tip.
Great. Well, I think we've covered quite a lot of ground there. Is there anything you would like to add, Paul or Sarah, before we start wrapping up? I'll make sure that our listeners know where they can find you. But on the topics we've been discussing, is there anything you think that we have missed that you'd like to mention, or anything else?
I feel we've covered a lot. And what I would want to mention for all the listeners out there is that don't let all of our technicality confuse you or scare you. It's actually very simple to ferment. It's an ancient culture, though. So if you think about that, we've been fermenting for so many years as a society that there is a lot, you know, you can go down a rabbit hole and there's so much you can do. But really, you can just get started with something so simple, just a salt brine. Try it out one time, get your feet wet with it. And once you feel comfortable, you can move on to other things.
It's a lot. It's very easy and it's also a lot of fun.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, guys. And make sure that you check out Paul and Sarah's YouTube channel. Why don't you tell people where they can find you?
So you can find us on YouTube at The Fermentation Adventure. Or if you want to go to our website, it's just fermentationadventure.com. We're also on all the social medias, but mostly it's just the YouTube and website.
Great. Great. Well, thank you ever so much, guys, for your time. It's been a real pleasure. And if ever I can return the favor somehow, just let me know. But thanks ever so much for giving up your time.
Thank you. It's been fun.
If you find this podcast valuable, there's several ways you can support it. The easiest of which is to rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. You could also talk about it or share it wherever you post online, including your social media pages. And now you can support the podcast directly by becoming a patron at patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. However you support the podcast, we really appreciate it. Thank you for listening. See you soon.